Hello, I'm Rhea Blakey for Discovery Health. Our topic today is surgery for colorectal disease. I'd like to thank the University of Virginia School of Medicine for accrediting the program. I'd also like to thank Ethicon Endosurgery for providing the educational grant to make this program possible. Physicians and other healthcare professionals can earn free CME credit by registering online at discoveryhealthcme.com and taking the post-test. All the graphics and references from today's program will also be available online. It's easy to log on, take the post-test, and earn free credit for the program, so do it today. We're pleased to welcome a distinguished group of experts to our studios today to discuss maximizing the benefits of surgery for disorders of the colon. Dr. Doug Rex, Chancellor's Professor of Medicine, Indiana University School of Medicine, Director of Endoscopy, Indiana University Hospital, Indianapolis, Indiana. Dr. Sonia Ramamurthy, Assistant Professor of Surgery, University of California, San Diego Medical Center, San Diego, California. And Dr. Anthony Senegor, Professor of Surgery, Michigan State University, Vice President of Research and Education, Spectrum Health System, Grand Rapids, Michigan. Thank you all for joining us today. During the next hour, we will discuss the epidemiology of disorders of the colon requiring surgery with attention to inflammatory bowel disease, diverticulitis, and colorectal cancer. Current knowledge regarding the indications for surgery in inflammatory bowel disease, including timing, the definition of treatment failure, and expected outcomes. Surgical options for inflammatory bowel disease with a focus on outcomes of specific techniques and minimally invasive approaches. Current recommendations for surgery in diverticulitis and knowledge regarding surgical options. And recent evidence regarding open versus laparoscopic approaches in colorectal cancer with a focus on patient selection and cancer-related outcomes. We'll be talking today about surgeries for a range of diseases that affect the colon. Let's start by reviewing the epidemiology, thinking about which patients are most likely to be affected. How would you describe the incidence and the prevalence of inflammatory bowel disease?
Ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease certainly are not rare diseases. They're seen, I think, sufficiently commonly that primary care physicians, most of them probably have one or several patients with one of these diseases in their practice. And when gastroenterologists go to clinic, we are regularly seeing several patients with inflammatory bowel disease in each one of these sessions. And across the country now, we have lots of gastroenterologists who are specializing in the management of inflammatory bowel disease. They only see patients with Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. These are diseases that we tend to think of as diseases of young people, and we should, because there's a peak in incidence between the ages of 15 and 30. But in fact, they can affect folks of any age. They can have their onset in childhood. They can have their onset in the elderly. And there may actually be a second peak in incidence later in life. And I think overall, the incidence has, there's some evidence at least that it's been going up over the last few decades.
How about diverticulitis? That's quite common, isn't it?
It is, and I think it's important to differentiate between diverticulosis and diverticulitis. Diverticulosis is the benign condition of having saccular outpouchings in a portion of the colon. It's commonly seen during colonoscopy and occurs in about 50% of people over the age of 60, most commonly seen in westernized countries, industrialized countries. Diverticulitis, on the other hand, is when those saccular outpouchings get infected. That condition is called diverticulitis.
Typically, diverticulosis is asymptomatic. So a lot of patients may have diverticulosis in your practice, but you have to distinguish what are diverticulitis symptoms that are a manifestation of infection versus irritable bowel syndrome, which is clearly a non-operative, medically managed disorder. So if it's just erratic bowel habits, it's more likely to be irritable bowel syndrome, even in a patient with diverticulosis. So it's important to make that distinction.
And I think that goes back to really getting a good history from the patient about symptoms, but then very importantly getting appropriate imaging at the time they're having those symptoms so you can differentiate between the two.
And how common is colorectal cancer? How many new cases per year, and who's most likely to be affected?
Unfortunately, it remains more common than it needs to be with the access to screening colonoscopy. This should effectively prevent the disease. There's approximately 100,000 new colon cancer cases per year and another 50,000 of rectal cancer. It still remains the third most common colon cancer amongst the genders. And within across the country, it's still the second most common cause of cancer death. So it's truly a challenge for our medical system. It does seem to disproportionately affect African-American population. That may be a combination of access to screening as well as some predisposition to the disease that we have not quite discovered yet.
I think Tony's suggesting that for primary care physicians, really the key thing to focus on is screening. Even when our patients are asymptomatic, we need to offer them screening tests because the disease is preventable. And age is our most important risk factor, so we start with everybody at age 50. But there are certain groups that are an increased risk. Tony mentioned African Americans. African Americans have higher mortality from colorectal cancer, which may be related to poor access to care. But they also actually have higher incidence. They get more cases, and they get them at an earlier age. And we've had some groups recommend that we should begin screening at age 45. That's not widely accepted, but it emphasizes how important it is to take steps to make sure that African Americans get screened. And other groups, cigarette smokers, patients with obesity, diabetes, these are groups that we should make special efforts to make sure that screening takes place, but really everybody over the age of 50. Mm.
For each of the three conditions we've described, there are both medical and surgical interventions. And we'll be talking mainly about the surgical interventions with a focus on the least invasive options. So let's start with ulcerative colitis. When a patient is hospitalized with a severe acute colitis due to inflammatory bowel disease, how often will medical treatment succeed, and is it clear when it fails?
For the patient that gets admitted with a severe, what we would call toxic colitis event, that is a life-threatening problem. It's one that needs aggressive early medical therapy. But there usually is a cascade of events with our medical treatment that tells which way the patient's going to go. Typically, if they don't respond within the first 48 hours, that's really a sign that they're not going to succeed with any more aggressive medical therapy, and surgery typically becomes offered earlier. Conversely, if they do respond earlier to the medical therapy, it starts to settle, their manifestations of toxicity decrease, then that may be someone who will go on to resolve their episode with medical therapy.
I would agree with that. And in the ideal setting, you have both a gastroenterologist and a surgeon involved with the patient's care from the beginning so that both people are monitoring their progress with medical therapy.
So-called fulminant colitis or toxic colitis, it's an uncommon presentation in ulcerative colitis. It's only a minority of patients who are going to present in that way. And an important thing is to recognize when is that going on. So this is the patient who looks acutely ill. They're having lots of bowel movements. They're regularly having bleeding. Their hemoglobin is low. Their albumin may be low. They're tachycardic. Sometimes they may even have a fever. So when we see that kind of clinical toxic picture, we need to get the specialist involved and the surgeon involved early, very early in the process, so that they can follow the patient along. In the traditional sort of treatment, you know, we often used IV steroids for as long as a week. But I think Tony's point is that even after 2 or 3 days, if the patient has not started to improve, even though if they are improving, the ultimate duration of that therapy could be a week, you know. Usually at 2 or 3 days, we can start to see if they've turned the corner. And if they haven't, then something else is going to need to be done besides IV steroids. And depending on the wishes of the patient, in some cases, it may be that surgery is the best approach, because we have to remember this is a curable disease, ulcerative colitis, and fulminant colitis is potentially fatal. So get the surgeon involved very early in the decision-making process.
Now, how about patients who are ambulatory? Is there a point at which elective surgery should be recommended?
There's really two situations in ulcerative colitis where we would need to consider surgery. One is the patient in whom we've just chronically failed. We've gone through the different medical options, of which there are several now, and which include biologic agents, and the patient is continuing to struggle. They are symptomatic. They may have persistent anemia, but they're not in a clinical remission. Their quality of life is not back to normal. And then the second situation in the chronic situation is when we are doing surveillance on these patients for colorectal cancer, and we find that they've got dysplasia in the colon, or they've developed a mass lesion that's dysplastic, that we think is related to the colitis, then these patients have to be considered for surgery. And I think in a lot of patients, we have to have a discussion with the patient about, as we escalate the therapy, the risks of the therapy, the toxicity of the therapy. Patients may not be able to tolerate medical therapy. And so it's appropriate as people are sick and not getting better that we raise the option of surgery because, again, it is a curable disease.
I think that's the ideal time for us to see the patient in our clinic as well because you're not in a rush to get them to the operating room and you have the time to sit down and address their concerns, allay their fears, talk to them about this other option. And often patients will opt for surgery once they've had a chance to sit down and talk to a surgeon about the possibility of cure from their ulcerative colitis.
In this case, it really does come down to quality of life issues. To have a medical treatment where you're still chronically ill, not feeling quite right, still having multiple bowel movements, surgery does present an effective cure for the disease. So to offer that earlier in that case would be an advantage for the patient.
I think there's also increased awareness from the patient's standpoint about increasing side effects from some of the new therapies, such as the biologics.
All right, well, let's turn to Crohn's disease. What's the role of medical therapy there, and how do you determine when that therapy may have failed?
Well, in Crohn's disease, we use a lot of the same medications, and medical therapy is still the cornerstone of treatment, but a higher percentage of patients with Crohn's disease are ultimately going to require an operation. Now, of course, surgery in Crohn's disease is not curative, and most patients who have surgery are eventually going to have a recurrence of the disease. But medical therapy, including some of the same classes of agents, the 5-aminosalicylates, when there is disease in the colon, although generally they're not quite as effective as they are in ulcerative colitis. The immunomodulator agents, such as azathioprine and 6-mercaptopurine. Corticosteroids play a role, although there's a school of thought that we should be trying to move away from steroids as much as possible. And then, of course, the biologic agents, the anti-tumor necrosis factor agents like infliximab, adalimumab, these have become also very important in the management of Crohn's disease.
What are the indications for surgery for Crohn's?
Typically in Crohn's disease, if you look nationally, actually the most common indication is failure of medical treatment, but the manifestations are usually obstruction. The disease, typically because it causes full-thickness bowel damage, when it even tries to heal, it will heal a scar and leave a relative obstruction. So if you look at case numbers, that's by far the most common cause for surgical intervention. And then we're faced with complications of the disease, perforation, abscess, hemorrhage, acute obstruction, and those have become, fortunately, less common events in today's world because of more effective medical therapy.
Well, many patients will be taking immunosuppressive medications when the decision for surgery is made. Do these medications affect the timing and or the outcomes of the surgery?
There are increased risks associated, and we are commonly used to operating on patients in this setting. I think one of the things that we always hope to do is catch a patient early so that they're not so systemically ill from their disease and the medications that they're on at the time of surgery. That just adds insult to injury. So there is a little bit of expected increased complication rate with all these medications. What we're trying to do is reduce the risk of poor nutrition and poor wound healing that'll occur if we've waited too long to operate.
I would agree. I think if you're stuck in an emergency situation for an acute complication, then you have to deal with those facts at that time. For a more scheduled procedure, my bias still is to try to get them off the immunosuppressive agents about 4 to 6 weeks for the 6-mercaptopurine class of medications, and for the biologics 2 to 3 weeks to try to decrease what is our most feared complication, which is anastomotic leak.
Dr. Ramamoorthy, what are the surgical options for ulcerative colitis and for Crohn's?
So they're two different disease processes and treated a little bit differently. In ulcerative colitis, we're looking to cure the process, and by doing so, we remove the entire colon and rectum. Now, there's different options for reconstruction. We can create intestinal continuity again by creating an ileoanal J pouch from the small intestine. In some patients, that's not possible, or they opt to have a ileostomy, which is the bowel being brought up to the skin level, to the abdominal wall, and they wear a bag permanently. There's also another option of what's called a continent ileostomy, which is a way of having the pouch at the level of the abdominal wall, but they're not constantly having an effluent through there like you would through an ileostomy. For Crohn's disease, the options really have to do with where the disease is located. So about a third of Crohn's disease patients will have small bowel disease, which may require simple what we call a strictureplasty, which is just an opening of the area that's narrowed, and repair it so that the contents of the bowel can flow freely through the area. If it's in the large bowel, it may be as simple as a resection of a small portion of it, or if it's a significant amount of bowel that's involved, you may have to remove the entire large bowel. And then the rectum, being the last 12, 15 centimeters of bowel, can also be involved, isolated or completely. So a lot of the surgeries we do is very tailored in Crohn's towards specifically treating the disease area, knowing that we're not going to cure it, but we're trying to prevent systemic demise or at least improve their quality of life.
I would agree. I think if for our primary care colleagues, I think there's, unfortunately, a lot of urban legend about the two illnesses that confuse decision-making if you're not dealing with this on a regular basis. For ulcerative colitis, the treatment does cure the disease process, which is different than Crohn's. And in Crohn's, both the medical and the surgical treatment is really palliative. We try to manage the symptoms. And so for me, the surgery for Crohn's disease is aimed at relieving that immediate complication that's adversely affecting the patient's quality of life, and then reuse medical therapy to try to decrease recurrence rates.
In recent years, one area of research in surgery for inflammatory bowel disease has involved ways to shorten recovery time and reduce the need for additional treatment. What is the role for minimal invasive surgery in ulcerative colitis and in Crohn's?
In many cases, this is the ideal group of patients for this approach because they're young, they have young families to return to, we want to get them back to their quality of life very quickly, and they already have some compromise of their immune system and physiology. So we really want to minimize the insult to injury with surgery. So for ulcerative colitis, the operation is curative by removing the colon and rectum and either reconstructing intestinal continuity with an ileoanal J pouch or creating an end ileostomy. And for Crohn's disease, it's approaching the segment of bowel that's diseased by either removing it or repairing it so that they can return to their quality of life and reduce the symptoms that they're having.
I agree. And in particular for the Crohn's patients, unfortunately, they are at risk for recurrent disease and need for additional surgical procedures. So to minimize the incision, minimize the risk of hernia formation, decrease the amount of adhesions inside the abdominal cavity, you can make another minimally invasive procedure available to them as well.
Some experts recommend a hand-assisted approach in some laparoscopic surgeries. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think it does have a role for some of the more complex surgical procedures. Total proctocolectomy, where there's a large segment of bowel that has to be removed from multiple quadrants inside the abdominal cavity, it can be more complex for surgeons that aren't as high volume or aren't as comfortable with pure laparoscopic approaches. It preserves most of the benefits of laparoscopic surgery and certainly is a viable alternative.
I think in many ways, when we consent patients for laparoscopic procedures, we're always consenting them for the possibility of open. But one middle ground is if we think we're having difficulty doing something laparoscopically, we can use the hand assist approach to give us the tactile information that we may need to help us continue with a minimal invasive approach without actually having to convert the patient to a complete open operation. So that's one advantage.